Walter Greenberg was 11 when he came to the United States. It wasn't quite what his family had expected.
My parents and my parents' friends were very disappointed that we were in a camp. We were happy that we were in America and we had left Italy because we had no place to go, really, and no home. We were on the run. We were refugees.
Greenberg was born in Italy. His father smuggled Jewish people from Austria to Yugoslavia before the war. The Greenbergs booked passage on a boat to North Africa, where they lived in a concentration camp for 3 months.
Then we were sent back to Italy. We were put in jail in Naples for close to a month till the first concentration camp was ready in Italy, which was called Ferramonti. We were in the camp for about a year and a half. We escaped from the camp with the help of the guards because they didn't care. It wasn't a place where they had extermination procedures, but people were dying from malnutrition and disease.
The family then went to a small town called Carsoli, where they stayed until Italy capitulated to Germany. Then they escaped into the Abruzzi Mountains.
We hid in the mountains with the help of Italian and Yugoslavian partisans. And my mother heard on a shortwave band radio that Rome was liberated, and we were south of Rome, which meant we were liberated too. So we hiked down the mountain, and we were picked up by army trucks and taken to Rome.
The 982 chosen ones didn't take the same route to Italy, but they all persevered when many of their friends and family members could not. Manja Breuer was in five different concentration camps between 1934 and 1944. She, her parents, and two brothers went from Germany to Poland, Belgium, and France together before they were separated. Breuer says her voice saved her.
Guarda il mare come bello. I loved to sing everywhere I was, so I kept on doing it. And, of course, people loved it, and I was called the singer. One day, a woman came in to take out a few children to an orphanage. She said, where's the singer? That's why I'm here today. I escaped that orphanage when the occupation came in, and I made it to the Italian border.
The German army was in retreat as Allied forces moved into Italy and France in 1944. The U.S. had rebuked the Nazis twice for Hitler's policy of exterminating Jews, but it could do little to stop the killing. By 1944, over 4 million Jews were dead. President Franklin Roosevelt met twice with world leaders to discuss the growing refugee problem, but he didn't change his policies to take in any refugees. In 1939, the U.S. turned away 930 Jewish refugees on board the St. Louis because of strict immigration quotas. Most of them were killed by the Nazis after the ship returned to Europe. The immigration quotas shrunk as the United States weathered the Depression. They remained unfilled as the nation went to war. Roosevelt's primary focus was the war, and anti-Semitism across the United States in the 1930s and 1940s meant there was less pressure on him to help European refugees. The first reports of Jewish deaths in Europe appeared in American and British media in June 1942. American Jewish organizations responded with protests and persuasion. In early 1944, Roosevelt established the War Refugee Board. The board suggested that the U.S. create temporary havens for refugees. With the presidential election looming, Roosevelt announced the establishment of the Fort Ontario Emergency Refugee Shelter on June 9, 1944. Ruth Gruber was a 32-year-old journalist working as special assistant to Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes at the time.
I rushed to his office and said, these refugees are going to be terrified, traumatized. Somebody has to hold their hand. And he said, you're right. Somebody must go over, and I'm going to send you.
The refugees came from 18 different countries and spoke 21 languages. The population was roughly one-third Yugoslav, one-fourth Austrian, 15% Polish, and 10% German. 872 people were Jewish, but there were also Greek Orthodox, Catholics, and Protestants. The refugees all signed a statement saying they would return to their home countries after the war. Then they boarded the Henry Gibbons, a military transport ship waiting in the Naples harbor. Ruth Gruber met them there for the first time.
My first sight was of people still in concentration camp pajamas, those striped black and white pajamas, barefoot children, men and women with no shoes and some with newspapers tied around their feet. It was a sight of refugees who had refugee eyes. They looked terrified. They had no idea what was in store for them.
The Henry Gibbons left Europe in a convoy of 29 American ships. The 982 refugees were in the front of the ship. Hundreds of wounded soldiers were in the stern. The journey across the Atlantic took 17 days. As Gruber gained the refugees' trust, she wrote down their stories. Some of the refugees were seasick during the journey. Others, like 16-year-old David Hendel, helped out on board.
We had a good time, actually. We had an opportunity to mingle with the sailors on the ship and people who were running the ship because we worked both in the kitchen and we worked in the garbage disposal and we did anything that had to be done by volunteers.
Manya Breuer remembers the food on the Henry Gibbons. After 10 years, the 21-year-old finally had choices.
I really felt like I was in another planet when I came up to the Henry Gibbons. There was meat, there was chicken, there was potatoes, there was milk, there was cereal, there was jam, there was fruit, there was bananas, there was apples. I dreamed for years for just one glass of milk, and I could get all the milk I wanted.
The ship's passengers were frightened by air raid and submarine alarms, but they also enjoyed the companionship and shared interests they discovered. Some of the refugees who were musicians sang for the wounded soldiers. Everyone crowded on deck to see the Statue of Liberty once the New York skyline came into view. A rabbi led a Hebrew prayer of thanksgiving. The memory of that moment still makes Peter Newman emotional.
I do remember passing the Statue of Liberty and all of us running over to cry as we saw that statue, saying that thank God that they had finally arrived in the States.
The Henry Gibbons docked on August 4, 1944. The next day, the refugees were disinfested and given identification tags labeled U.S. Army casual baggage. Then they boarded the train to Oswego. Ruth Gruber remembers the refugees' initial response to their new home.
There was camp right there with the fence and the barbed wire, and several of them turned on me. They said, "Mother Ruth, you know what we went through. How could you do this to us? How could you bring us to America and then put us in another camp with a fence and barbed wire?"
The government had made clear that the refugees were here on unusual legal terms. The fence was another reminder. It was a chicken wire fence with three strands of barbed wire across the top, a typical boundary of any army camp. For some refugees, the fence signified another concentration camp. For others, it meant safety. But for most, it dashed the dreams they'd had of total freedom in America. Even at 6 years old, Peter Newman recognized both sides of the fence.
I can remember very vividly my parents and I running to the barbed wire that surrounded us. We realized here we were in America, but we were still behind barbed wire fences. And of course, obviously, realizing that we now had a place where we could eat, talk, and where we could enjoy ourselves.
Manya Breuer was relieved that the fence was there.
I knew I was safe. I knew I was on American soil, that nobody's come up to kill me. And I was not surrounded by enemies. I was surrounded by friends. I wasn't free to go out, but it didn't bother me. I was happy to go to the lake, to go and walk the grounds and pick flowers, to see the blue skies. And I was happy, just to be alive.
Walter Greenberg didn't mind the fence when he arrived in Oswego. But 60 years later, its meaning has changed.
You can take this boy out of the camp, but you can't take the fence out of the boy. It has remained within me. It has been part of me. But I think the fence represented more all the years of the war and what has happened to my family, not just Fort Ontario.
Still, the refugees settled into the 80-acre camp. Former soldiers' barracks had been renovated into small, spare apartments. Families and single women had their own apartments. Single men shared dormitories. Toilets and showers were communal. Visitors were not allowed at the camp during the month-long quarantine. After Labor Day, the refugees could go into the city of Oswego on six-hour passes. Even then, they could not travel to Syracuse or visit family members in other parts of the country. But friends, family, and even Eleanor Roosevelt came to see them. Oswego residents were curious about their new neighbors, too. Townspeople lined up along the wire fence to talk with the refugees and bring them gifts. 17-year-old Francis Enright, who lived across the street from the shelter, was one of them.
They were all along the fence. I had an autograph book with me, and I started talking to this young girl. We communicated, but it was only like a word here and a word there. So I thought, well, gee, they came over from that way. So I said, Capisce Italian? And her face just lit up, and she said, yes. So I started speaking Italian to them.
Oswego residents welcomed the refugees, but it took them a while to accept some of their habits. Carol McLaughlin was a 21-year-old senior at the Oswego State Teachers College when the refugees arrived. She remembers one incident in particular.
I can remember being in a dress shop, Campbell's dress shop, and they'd see a blouse and they'd try it on right out in the aisles. This upset a few people, but eventually everything resolved itself and people got along very well.
Life began to take on a sense of normalcy. Within the first month, the group's first bar mitzvah and brit milah, or circumcision ceremony, took place. Manya Breuer was the camp's first bride. She married Ernst Breuer, a 26-year-old Austrian she had met in the concentration camp in France. The couple had wanted to marry on the Henry Gibbons, but the captain told them they had to wait until they got to America. But it wasn't that simple. To marry legally in New York State, the couple had to leave the shelter during the quarantine to get a marriage license at City Hall.
When they finally gave me permission, I was ushered out of Fort Ontario by two deputies. And they ushered me to the City Hall and brought me back to Fort Ontario. Ruth Gruber's mom came to visit Ruthie, and they couldn't find in all of Oswego a wedding veil because the nylon was used for parachutes. So Ruthie said to her mom, please bring some a veil or material for a veil from New York. So what did her mother do? She was crocheting a veil for me.
Joseph Smart was the camp director. Before coming to Oswego, he had been in charge of some of the Japanese-American relocation centers. He had tried to make the shelter more comfortable for the refugees. A synagogue and a kosher kitchen were built for the Orthodox residents, and a bakery was created to supply the dark bread so hard to find in Oswego. There were vocational and language classes for the adults. But the worry that they would have to return to Europe after the war always lurked just beyond the bustle of daily life. The residents adopted the new Cole Porter song, Don't Fence Me In, as their anthem.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in.
The camp was full of music and performances. Manya Breuer and Leo Merkovich, principal tenor in the Yugoslav National Opera, starred in musical revues. The camp established its own orchestra. Residents held dances and invited townspeople to them. And local music groups and dramatic clubs came to the shelter to entertain residents, too. Carol McLaughlin visited with the college symphonic choir and was impressed with what she saw.
They had such talent over there, artists and musicians and people really very, very talented. They were a city within a city.
When the school year began in September, 193 shelter residents between 5 and 21 years old were in Oswego classrooms. 9 more matriculated at the college the following January. Oswego High School principal Ralph Faust came to the shelter and interviewed each of the students to assess their skills. Margareta Fissi, who entered 9th grade at age 18, remembers one example of Faust's dedication.
He asked me a question, what's the most important document that the United States has, you know? I just could not remember the name. So he tried to help me out by saying, what do you do every morning or every evening? And I still couldn't figure it out. He said, Konsti and Duschen in German means to take a shower, of course. And I thought that was really giving it away, but he wanted to help us.
Ruth Gruber remembers Faust fondly.
Ralph Faust was absolutely most wonderful educator that any of us could imagine. Ralph Faust was a noble soul. He changed the life of every one of those high school students. That high school molded them.
But even with supportive educators, the children still had to make the transition from European to American classrooms. Sylvan Bonney was 12 when he started school at Fitzhugh Park School. He hadn't been to school since the second grade because his family had been running for so many years.
What I do remember is sitting in a classroom of kids looking at me as if I were a different species. and a very nice, warm, accepting teacher. And within minutes, if not hours, kids being more and more friendly.
David Furman wrote in his memoir about the day 8 refugees joined his 6th grade class.
One day our classroom door opened and in walked the principal and 8 refugee children. They looked just like us, although most looked older than we did. Of all the characteristics I noted, the one that stood out most in my mind was the fact that all 8 were thin. Not one was at all overweight. The principal introduced them to us, although he stumbled over some of their last names. Then we stood one by one and introduced ourselves to them. We were surprised at how well they all spoke English, plus 2 or 3 other languages.
Children in the shelter frequently adapted to American life more quickly than their parents did. A few teenagers snuck out of camp to travel to New York City for the weekend. There were regular romantic rendezvous between town and shelter teens on both sides of the fence. But adults did not come and go as the children did. They learned English more slowly. Winter shocked the shelter residents. After years in a Mediterranean climate, they weren't prepared for the snow, wind, and bitter cold. They couldn't escape it. Morale dropped throughout the shelter. One shelter resident committed suicide because of her guilt over leaving 2 children behind in Europe. Another was killed by a frozen coal pile that fell on him while he was shoveling coal to heat the barracks. President Roosevelt died in April. The bad news and harsh weather seemed endless. But spring brought news of continued Allied victories in Europe and a number of new babies that made everyone hopeful again. Along with the births came a pressing question. Were these babies Americans? They had been born in the United States, but their parents were in legal limbo as guests of the government. This frustrated Manya Breuer. She wanted her newborn daughter, Diane, to be an American citizen.
They had to have a session in the house. They had to have a special meeting that they put together to find out if my daughter was indeed an American citizen or not. She was born on American soil, and I kept on saying, what, was she born on Chinese soil? My daughter's an American, and I went around saying that and was so disappointed. And then finally, of course, they decided yes.
Rumors were flying in the camp that the refugees were to be returned to Europe. Most of them preferred to immigrate to the United States. A number had begun immigration proceedings before the war. On May 7, 1945, Germany surrendered to the Allies. Joseph Smart resigned from his post as shelter director to lobby in Washington for the refugees to be allowed to stay. A month and a half later, the War Refugee Board dissolved, and responsibility for the shelter shifted to Ruth Gruber's boss, Harold Ickes. Smart, Gruber, and Ickes lobbied hard to keep the refugees in the U.S. So did Jewish organizations and many Oswego residents, including Ralph Faust. Congress held hearings and decided to close the Fort Ontario Emergency Refugee Shelter. Ruth Gruber remembers when President Truman announced his decision in late December.
Truman said, we will allow them to cross over into Canada, get the proper visas, and come back into the United States, and then apply for citizenship.
The refugees were invited to live in 70 communities around the U.S. Many went to New York City, including Walter Greenberg and David Hendel. Sylvan Bonney went to Philadelphia. Peter Newman went to Kansas City, Missouri. Margareta Fissi went to San Francisco. Manya, Ernst, and Diane Breuer went to Los Angeles. By February 6, 1946, all the refugees had left the Fort Ontario Emergency Refugee Shelter. 854 of them immigrated immediately to the United States. The initial transition from the shelter to their new homes was difficult for most of them. But every one of them recognized that they would have to work hard to succeed in the United States. And they did. One man helped develop the CAT scan and the MRI. Another helped create the Polaris missile. The refugees became doctors, teachers, social workers, engineers, businessmen, artists, and musicians. Most of the former shelter residents say they are grateful for being given the opportunity to start new lives in the U.S. Manya Breuer is among them.
Oswego was my lifeline. I would say my transfusion, like a blood transfusion to life. All my blood was taken from my body. And when I came to Oswego, Oswego gave me back my life.
But some, like Walter Greenberg, are more conflicted. He felt he had everything but his freedom in the shelter. And while he thinks back fondly on the city, he was unable to speak about it for years. It wasn't until he returned to Oswego in 1983 that he realized why that was.
As a child, I got used to being either in prison or in confinement or in a camp or in hiding. And I knew how to survive within that area. That was my world. when I came to America, I was told America is the land of the free. And I realized that the bitter experience of the camp really was that I wasn't upset at the camp, but I was upset that I didn't have a normal childhood and that it was a gross injustice to put us in a camp behind the fence. That we were treated well, but we were treated with caution.
Sharon Lowenstein is a historian who wrote a book about the shelter. She takes her criticism of the government's actions a step further.
This one shelter is the result of a failed effort to open up the United States to people fleeing from Hitler during World War II and to bring over tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people as a saving measure. This was very much of a token. We brought POWs to this country. They had more freedom than this one token group of 1,000.
Many former shelter residents fight to maintain the balance between gratefulness and guilt. Manya Breuer says it's a constant struggle.
We were just the drop in the bucket. All the rest of us, going through what they went through, really should have had a chance at life and a better life. The few people that came to Oswego, my God, I always felt guilty. Why am I here? The others not.
Breuer takes comfort in knowing she and her three children have accomplished good things. Walter Greenberg believes that the former shelter residents should be proud of what they achieved and contributed, individually and collectively.
I'm not sorry I was in a camp. I think the camp is part of me. It's an integral part of me, of who I am. I've learned there and through my parents the importance of having compassion and understanding for other people who are in need. And I think that it's that fence in me that has helped me to be that way.
That the U.S. government welcomed refugees by putting them behind a fence is surprising. That it didn't do more to support Jewish refugees overseas is disappointing. But the fact that so many Oswego shelter residents turned the trauma of their experiences into productivity and generosity is a testament to the strength of the human spirit. For the WRVO stations, this is Sky Road.